On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Senate Assistant Minority Leader Janet Buley on the line, and we'll get her perspective on a variety of bills moving through the Capitol, starting with Republicans' $250 million income tax cut plan that they presented Friday. It's a plan that should have a hearing today, perhaps, and a vote later this week. What do you think about the tax cut proposal? What should the state do with its budget surplus? How do you think Democrats should be working in the Republican-controlled legislature? Be part of the State Cap conversation, 800-642-1234. Janet Buley is a Democrat who represents a big part of northwest Wisconsin. Her district includes Superior, Ashland, Rice Lake, much of the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. Senator Buley, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate having a chance to talk about this.
So this anticipated surplus in state tax collections, it has the governor and Republicans proposing different types of tax cuts this year. What kind of cut would you support in taxes?
I think that the governor's plan is the way to go. It allows for increased school funding, particularly in the areas where we need it the most, which is special education and mental health. It gets the schools to two-thirds funding by the state, and I'll explain that in a minute. And it also allows for a property tax cut. The Republican plan is strictly a portion will buy down debt, and it will allow for an income tax cut. So the governor and I agree, we believe that we can both fund our schools and bring a tax cut to the people of Wisconsin.
How much of this expected surplus should be set aside for tax relief versus paying down state debt?
Well, first of all, let's look at what existing law is now. If there is a surplus, half of it has to go into the rainy day fund, period. They have to do that right now. So using really rough numbers, we're going to have to, we've got maybe about $400 to $450 million to anticipate we can spend. And that's very important. I'd like to use the future tense completely when we have this conversation. We don't have a pile of cash sitting on the table in front of us. This is all projected. And when we do have a chance to actually spend it, we've got to make sure we do it in a way that is both durable, it will really make a difference in a way that we can continue to keep that funding, and that it will return money to the taxpayers in the form of a tax cut. When we talk about the governor's plan, by increasing or making sure that two-thirds of the expenses of schools, the general expenses of schools, are funded from Madison, meaning general purpose revenue that comes in, then it goes back to the schools. If we get that to two-thirds, as the Republicans have promised they would do, less money would have to be acquired from property tax. More money that comes from Madison, less property tax. So we want to make sure that we get to that place, as the Republicans have promised. Secondly, the Democrats want to make sure that we can provide the special education funding that schools so desperately need, and that we have money for mental health. These are two areas that are critically important. And speaking from someone who represents a rural area, it is it's a huge burden on rural schools. So we've got to look at that. That is something that we have been promising we were going to do. And with the Democratic, with the governor's plan, we can do that. The Republican plan merely provides for income tax relief. Now, that's helpful, but it doesn't fulfill that promise of getting the schools to two-thirds funding.
Talking with Democratic Senator Janet Buley from Mason in the northwestern part of the state, you can join in. How do you want lawmakers to handle this anticipated tax surplus? Do you support more funding for schools as Governor Evers has proposed, or do you want tax cuts as Republicans have proposed? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Susan now in Milwaukee with thoughts on this. Hi, Susan.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
I have two things that I think that money should be spent on. Ridiculous that we should be looking at a tax break. $100 that we didn't have before is not going to make a difference for anyone. If it was $200, even if it was $500, the reality is it won't make a real lasting difference. This can make a lasting difference if we get ourselves back to that two-thirds mark. The other thing, the other half of that money should be spent on getting broadband into the northern part of the state. Now, I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but I come from farm country. I'm 73, so I haven't lived there in a long time. But wherever those folks in the northern part of the state live, they need to have the kind of access that we have to the Internet. And that's something that if we did it for telephone lines, we know that it needs to be done. It should be done, and it should be done with this money. I'm going to let you go.
Susan, thank you for the call. And State Senator Bewley, she's really honed in on connectivity in the rural parts of our state with broadband.
Well, I think that thank you, Susan, for that. And thank you for also pointing out that under the Republican plan, the average savings for taxpayers would be a little over $100. That's it, the average. So it really wouldn't have that kind of an impact where it's going to be a life changer for people. But being able to invest the money in schools and in rural areas is significantly important. Now, if you look at the thing that she pointed out about rural broadband, that's absolutely true. I mean, we've got schools where the standard is that the kids get a laptop to take home. Well, it's useless up here. I mean, I would say most of the area, but a large, large portion of rural Wisconsin does not have broadband and in the home. So all of the expected things that we do for our schools with test taking or things that you can do on the Internet at home is meaningless in rural areas. Also, the consistency of broadband and the speeds are also wholly inadequate up here. And if we want northern Wisconsin, if we want rural Wisconsin, if we want all of Wisconsin to thrive, we must invest in our schools and in connectivity equal throughout the state.
When do you expect the legislature will start debating the governor's special session proposals on schools?
Well, I'm really not sure about that. Again, a special session is something that can be asked by the governor. Whether or not it will go to the floor and actually have a conversation, that is up to the leadership to schedule it and to make sure that everybody gets to the floor. If they gavel in and gavel out, it doesn't. That's the last time a special session was called. That's exactly what happened. No discussion took. But right now we have actual bills. The Republican introduced a bill, and the Democrats technically have a bill as well with the governor's plan that can be taken up at any time. Now, we expect to go to the floor. By we, I mean the Senate. We're going to go to the floor on Wednesday of this week and at least once more in March. And the assembly is going to go to the floor at least one more time, probably in late February or in March. I'm not sure. So these can happen quickly. And so it's very important that people let their representatives and senators know how they feel about these proposals.
We have Senate Assistant Minority Leader Janet Bewley of Mason on the line for the State Capitol Report. What questions do you have for her? Are you a farmer? What should be done about the state's dairy crisis? 800-642-1234. There's more State Cap in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democratic State Senator Janet Bewley from northwestern Wisconsin is on the line. She's weighing in on a variety of bills moving through the Capitol and also what to do with this anticipated surplus. State officials got new projections last month that the state will have an extra $620 million in its main account by July 2021, even after setting aside money for the state's rainy day fund. We're at 800-642-1234. And Senate Assistant Minority Leader Janet Buley stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Tom is joining us from Blair this morning. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Well, I, having lived here a while and witnessed Jesse Ventura in Minnesota, I'm wondering how you justify when you have a surplus, which means you collected too much tax money, not giving that money directly back to voters like Jesse Ventura did in the 90s. How do the Democrats or the Republicans, being not aligned to either one of them, justify keeping our money that we overpaid?
Tom, thanks for the call. Senator Buley, what about just giving the full amount back to taxpayers?
Well, I think that it's important to realize that the surplus is not necessarily just what the income taxpayers paid. You know, the state receives revenue from a multitude of sources, and the actual amount of money that we have to spend is not kind of moves around a bit. So to single out one source of revenue and to say that's where all of our surplus is going to go might not be fair either, because it might not be the individual taxpayers who footed the bill for all of these things that we're doing. They do deserve to see that the money is well spent. And that is how we basically do it. We anticipate the revenue, and we allocate to the best of our ability how that money should be spent. And sometimes we're short, and sometimes we have a little bit extra. But returning all of it directly to the taxpayers, the residents of Wisconsin, might not be the accurate and fair way to distribute, because I don't think it represents the bulk of the money that the state might be receiving. Keep in mind also that when you pay your taxes, you are basically saying, I'm contributing to the entire state, and I want my money to make it good for everybody, so that if we have a surplus, we're following that intention to make sure that the money is well spent. And now that's what the Republicans and the Democrats are proposing. What should we do? And it should be spent well, and it should benefit the entire state.
Tom, thanks for the call. Let's go to Shane now in Waupun. Shane, hi.
Good morning. I was just wondering, if we take the surplus money and we spend it on schools to get up to that two-thirds mark, what are we going to do in the future? Are we just going to bank on that there's going to be a surplus to keep that at two-thirds? Or I don't get how that would be sustainable.
Shane, thank you for the call. State Senator Buley, how would that be sustainable with one-time money?
Well, keep in mind that we have sort of benchmarks that we use when we're budgeting. We know approximately how much we're going to spend on transportation based on the projects. In the schools, we have said, and we typically always wanted to be at two-thirds. It never used to be a fungible thing. Well, oh, no, we're only going to give that much. We want to get to two-thirds so that the next time we budget, we're going to say, yeah, we're going to keep our promise. We're going to keep it at two-thirds, and the other things that can be moved around, we'll move them around. I mean, the state has the ability to make these decisions from one budget to the next. And I think it's important that we live up to our promises and make sure that we spend those tax dollars in the way, for example, that Governor Evers and the Republicans have said they would.
We're catching up with Janet Buley, a Democratic state senator who represents a large part of the northwestern part of our state. we had, after Governor Evers called the special session, Republican Representative Jim Steinke was on our program saying that lawmakers should consider boosting funds for education in the normal budget process next year and not now.
This is something that we've gone through the budget process last year. We set out what we wanted to spend, and now we have more money. That just doesn't mean that we should go out and grow the size of government. I think it's something that we should return to the taxpayers.
What do you make of that sentiment?
Well, first of all, keep in mind that we based our budget on what we anticipated, and now we have a surplus. If we get if we go along with that, the next time we have to build the budget, we're going to have to bring those taxes back up to a place where we can actually propose a budget as we did before. And then what are we going to do? Raise taxes? I think it's kind of unfair to, on one hand, say you shouldn't bank on two-thirds funding, you know, now and in the future, but we're doing that in a way when we say we're going to cut taxes. If we cut taxes now, then what's going to happen the next time when we don't have the money? It's the same critique of we've got to make sure that we are as close as we can be. And when we have a surplus, we have to do the right thing. But cutting taxes will only mean that in the next budget, we might have to raise taxes. And that's just unfair to the taxpayer.
We need to move on here to agriculture. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says Republicans are supportive of the governor's special session to help farmers, but they want to go, quote, bigger and bolder. Do you agree that lawmakers should be doing more than the governor proposed?
I think when the Republicans say go bigger and bolder, they mean let's kick the can to the next budget. We have to do things now. And I think that the most important thing is to realize that, number one, for me, mental health care in the entire rural area for everybody, including access for farmers quicker and in a way where it's going to really, really make a difference. Bigger and bolder, I want to see exactly what's going to happen and how we're going to be able to do it now. We can pass bills right now that are going to make a difference for farmers. The other thing that we have to do is realize that this is a problem that's going to involve state and federal policy. We cannot, as a state, make the kinds of adjustments that unless we have the federal government involved as well. Farmers have many things that are causing this problem. And the smaller that the farm is, the more unpredictable crops and dairy are in terms of pricing and things like the weather and flooding. We do not have a way, on the state level, to give any kind of security or stability to farmers the way we always say we want to do with business. And the number of farms that I have in this district where I am are typically smaller. A lot of them are based on actual crops rather than dairy. We've got to look at a way to have all kinds of farming, from big ag all the way to the small organic farms, thrive in our state.
I want to end here on Husky. Last week, the legislature's budget committee approved a long-pending legal settlement over the 2018 Husky refinery explosion in Superior. What does a settlement mean for the community as it tries to recover from that explosion?
Well, first of all, I would say that the community has recovered. I believe that Superior is strong. I have spent a lot of time there. And the settlement means we're moving on. And there's a much closer relationship with Husky than ever before. It was good before. Now it's phenomenal. We know.
In what way?
Pardon me?
In what way is it phenomenal now?
Well, we've seen a sincere desire to keep the community informed, to have the people that live in in the Superior area know that they can ask questions and get answers. We have a great relationship between the firefighters. The Husky has its own emergency response team and their own techniques. The Superior Fire Department regularly trains with Husky on how you respond to emergencies. And right now, of course, they're completely what's called turning it around, which is something they do, and they were in the process of doing that when the explosion occurred. And they are building in even more safety measures into when the build-out of Husky when it reopens.
State Senator Bewley, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Janet Bewley is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 25th Senate District, which includes Superior. She's also the Senate Assistant Minority Leader. Coming up, we look into the statewide election tomorrow. That includes a primary for the state Supreme Court. Stay with us. News update is next right here on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One programming note here. Join us tomorrow afternoon at 1 for the annual State of the Tribes address streaming online at WPR.org. Forest County Pottawatomie Chairman Ned Daniels presents the address before a joint session of the legislature, and you can catch a rebroadcast of the State of the Tribes address tomorrow evening at 7 right here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're exploring the latest in state politics, starting with the spring primary for Wisconsin Supreme Court that is set for tomorrow. Also noteworthy here, voters in the 7th Congressional District will have a congressional primary tomorrow as well. That's a seat that was vacated by former Congressman Sean Duffy. Are you a registered voter, or do you plan to register at the polls tomorrow? How are you going to vote in tomorrow's Supreme Court primary? What do you like about the candidates? What have they been saying in their campaigns that interests you? 800-642-1234. Patrick Marley covers state politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on.
So you've been covering the state Supreme Court primary election. How have you heard these three candidates trying to distinguish themselves to the voters?
Well, Justice Daniel Kelly is part of the conservative majority on the court. He was appointed in 2016 and is now seeking a full 10-year term. He's positioned himself, like a lot of conservatives have in the past, in the mold of Antonin Scalia or other textualists, saying that he interprets the law as written, very much stresses that he's not going to put his own ideas into his opinions. His opponents have won backing from liberals. That's Ed Falone and Joe Karofsky. Karofsky is a judge in the Dane County Circuit Court, and Falone is a longtime law professor at Marquette University. They say that Kelly is not what he appears, that he has an agenda, and that they would be more independent-minded. Karofsky really talked a lot about her values, stressed those, which are often along with sort of progressive viewpoints. Has been maybe left shy than other candidates about stating her personal opinions, such as, you know, her opposition to Donald Trump, for instance.
Saying that she did not vote for him in 2016 and wouldn't vote for him in the future?
That's correct. Whereas the other candidates won't say what, and as is typical with judicial candidates, won't say how they would vote in partisan elections. Dan Kelly did get an endorsement from Donald Trump. He was in Milwaukee in January, and he gave a brief shout out to Kelly from the stage. Falone has said that he thinks one problem with Supreme Court elections in the past is that candidates like Kelly have sort of put forth this overarching judicial philosophy that they say they adhere to. He says there's no sort of one-size-fits-all philosophy, that each case has to be approached independently and specific to those facts rather than trying to shoehorn it into a specific way of looking at the law.
Justice Dan Kelly fell under public scrutiny when Governor Walker appointed him to the bench in 2016. His appointment drew controversy because of his writings on same-sex marriage and affirmative action. Have we learned new information about Justice Kelly from his first election, his actions on the bench?
So before he was on the court, he maintained a blog with some other conservatives. And so that did draw attention at the time and has in this election because of his opposition to same-sex marriage, his statement that abortion, people who support abortion do so, or organizations that support abortion do so to protect sexual libertinism, and that they know that they're harming children. So those statements have drawn attention, have drawn some criticism. He has since taken those blogs down and said that at that time it was okay for him to state his views because he wasn't a judge or a judicial candidate. Now that he is, he tries to separate himself from his personal views and doesn't talk about them.
Is Justice Kelly running a campaign similar to Justice Brian Hagedorn, part of the court's, you know, conservative wing, who voters elected last year?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand your question there.
Yeah, is Justice Kelly running a similar campaign to the campaign that Justice Brian Hagedorn ran last year?
Oh, I mean, I think his campaign is similar. Sure, there's similarities with the Hagedorn campaign. There's similarities with the way lots of conservatives have run in the past. Conservatives have had a very successful decade on the Supreme Court, and there have been some races that they lost, notably the one that Rebecca Dowlett won a couple of years ago. But conservatives had a very effective strategy in getting their supporters to the polls. And so, you know, as when liberals or Democrats have successes, they repeat those strategies. The conservatives are doing the same thing here.
We're catching up on state politics with Patrick Marley, who covers the Capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in. What questions do you have about the court battle over whether to remove more than 200,000 names from voter registration databases? How do you think this should be resolved? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sticking with the primary election tomorrow, let's go to Mark now, joining us from Appleton. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I just wanted to say that I'm become a supporter for Jill Karofsky. She appeared before our group of I've been getting involved with these Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in Appleton, and she came and gave us a brief talk, and very impressive. And I just wanted to echo my support for her.
When you say very impressive, Mark, what stood out?
You need to ask me that. I just felt like she had some progressive ideals and that she had, you know, common sense solutions. I guess I can't pin down anything too specific, but yeah.
Yeah. Mark, thank you for the call. Patrick, do you find Jill Karofsky's first time running for the Supreme Court? She has talked about trying to follow the path of Justice Rebecca Dowlett, part of the court's liberal wing. Do you see similarities there in their campaigns and what they represent?
So you asked before if Kelly was using the model of Hagedorn, and of course, conservatives are trying. He is trying to replicate that campaign because Hagedorn had a come from behind victory in that race. Similarly, Karofsky is trying to follow the model of Rebecca Dowd, because she's one of the few liberals who was able to win. She won an open seat a couple of years ago after a long string of conservatives winning such races. And so, yeah, I think Karofsky is trying to follow a similar path. Fallon maybe is a little different model. Ed Fallon ran in 2013 and lost to Patience Rubensack. I think he's trying to build on the support that he did find in that race. So maybe a little bit of a different model, but I do think there are parallels between what Karofsky is trying to do and what Rebecca Dowlett did do.
Justice Kelly has led the field in fundraising. How much of an advantage from campaign cash does that give a candidate?
Yeah, it's really big. He's raised, almost $1 million, not quite that much, but he got an earlier head start because he was on the court and knew that he was running again. Karofsky's raised, I think, less than half the that, and then Ed Sloan considerably less than that. So there is a big fundraising edge here. and that will likely persist whoever gets through the primary. However, you know, probably the Liberal will be able to consolidate some support. Their outside spending would probably begin after the primary. So I think you'll start to see things even out money-wise, but it does look like Kelly's going to be able to maintain a pretty big edge in fundraising.
So if one candidate ends up winning a big portion of the vote tomorrow, how much does that forecast their chances in April?
I think it's hard to draw too many conclusions because you're going to have a much bigger turnout in April than you do in February. You always have a higher turnout at the general election. And then, of course, this year, the April 7th general election for Supreme Court is the same day as the primary in the presidential race. And so you'll see a lot more voters coming out. So, you know, you could have someone who places first in the primary could come in second in the general. So I don't think you can read too much in terms of the vote share in tomorrow's primary to the general election.
Well, let's go back to the phones now with Sargi in Lake Haley.
Lake Haley, yes.
Yes, yes. Go ahead.
I've always wondered this. If we're supposed to be a representative democracy, why are we stopping people from voting? Why is voting not a mandatory thing, even if you just vote, I don't want to vote?
Sargi, thanks for the call. Patrick, you know, what can you say about the representative democracy statement there?
Yeah, so I don't know. You know, I haven't heard that idea of making voting mandatory. Certainly there are things that could be done to encourage more people to vote. You know, we have the system that elected officials have put in place. They've set the voting rules. You know, I think it's up for policymakers. It's not up for me to decide what the rules should be. I'm just a reporter. I just tell you what they are.
Well, one issue being appealed in the courts right now is whether the more than 200,000 names should be removed from voter registration lists. You recently analyzed the voting records. What did you learn?
So, yeah, there's 232,000 people who got letters in the fall from the state saying they believe that they had moved and should either update their voter registrations or confirm if they hadn't moved that they're still at the same address. The state planned to take those people off the rolls in 2021, but then a lawsuit came along saying they should get off the rolls much faster. So far, that lawsuit has not been successful. No one's been taken off the rolls, but, you know, the appeals court is considering it now. Could eventually get to the Supreme Court, so that could change. What we found when we looked at who got the letters, it's a very reliable set of voters. 72% of them voted in 2016's presidential election. I think, what was it, almost a third of them had voted in all three of the last presidential elections. 78% of them voted in at least one of those three.
Well, let's pause right there with those numbers. We have the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel state politics reporter Patrick Marley with us as our guide as we look at the latest in state politics. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we have the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel State Capitol reporter Patrick Marley as our guide on this installment of the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's look now at competing legislation over sexual assault evidence. The Assembly passed a Republican version of a bill to prevent a future backlog of sexual assault kits last week, but that drew sharp criticism from Democrats for including provisions related to immigration and school vouchers. What do you think of the GOP proposal that is headed to the Senate? Are you a police officer, an attorney, a nurse, someone else who works with survivors of sexual assault? What do you think is needed to improve how Wisconsin handles sexual assault cases and evidence? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And Patrick Marley stays with us. So, Patrick, another battle in the Capitol this month involves the legislative proposals to change how the state manages evidence from sexual assault cases. There is now competing legislation in the chambers. What is at the heart of this dispute?
So the bulk of these bills do the same thing. The Senate passed it in the fall on a voice vote, really no opposition to it. The Assembly passed it on partisan lines here the other day. This is to prevent future backlogs with sexual assault kits. So it would set procedures for who collects the evidence, who's responsible for storing it, how quickly it is processed, gives victims more involvement in the case, so they can more involvement in their cases, so that they can track where their evidence is, require it to be processed within 90 days, and so those are all those are both in both versions of the bill. What differs is the assembly version has this provision that says if the suspected assailant is an undocumented person, that ICE has to be called. And if a student is assaulted by a classmate or school staff, they would automatically be able to enroll in voucher schools. Immigration and voucher issues, you know, those are things that inspire very strong reactions between the two parties. And so that sent the Democrats off of the assembly bill very quickly. The key problem here is that you know, the Assembly and Senate have passed different versions of the bill. There's no sign that they're going to reconcile those differences. And so if they don't do that, and if they don't do it very quickly, then nothing's going to happen. And they won't be able to address backlogs of sexual assault kits in any fashion this legislative session.
Why did Republicans say that new legislation was needed on this?
So it's interesting that, you know, this thing started out in the version that passed the Senate. It was bipartisan. It had support pretty steadily along. But then it got stuck in the Assembly. And so David Steffen, one of the lead sponsors of the bipartisan bill, quickly introduced, sort of abruptly introduced, this new version with these other provisions. He said he did that because he needed to find a way to get this bill through the Republican-controlled Assembly, and that he wanted to move the process along. So, you know, the Assembly was stuck. They couldn't apparently get support behind the bipartisan bill, and so they advanced this alternate version of it.
What have we heard out of Governor Evers? Has he voiced whether he would sign the new bill into law?
So he hasn't. So there's no bill getting to him so far because the two parties or the two houses haven't been able to agree. He has generally, like the Attorney General, supported the original bipartisan bill, but Evers has not told us whether he would sign or veto the Republican bill if it gets to him. So I think if the Senate does end up taking the Assembly version of the bill, it's going to be a real question as to whether the governor will swallow those parts of the bill that he doesn't like and sign it, or if he vetoes it and tells the legislature to go start over again, which would be the next legislative session most likely, which doesn't start till a year from now.
If no legislation is passed, where does that leave the state in terms of preventing another backlog of sexual assault evidence?
So the State Department of Justice says right now that there's not a backlog. This is sort of forward-looking legislation, and this is why some of the Republicans in the Assembly say there's not an urgency here. We don't have a backlog. There was a previous backlog that got cleared under current law, and so we can look at this. We can find a way to address it, but it's not a matter of sort of emergency because there is no existing backlog.
We're talking state politics with Patrick Marley, who covers the Capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in. What do you think about the delays in closing the youth prison, Lincoln Hills? What do you think of the plan for smaller regional facilities? What questions do you have about juvenile detention centers in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. Patrick, you've been covering the state's embattled youth prisons since they were raided in 2015 following allegations of inmate abuse. Lawmakers had approved a plan to close Lincoln Hills by July 2021, but those plans have had a bunch of setbacks. What are the latest developments in this?
So it's interesting. Lawmakers decided in 2018 that they were going to close Lincoln Hills, and at that time they were going to close it by the beginning of 2021, passed a bill to do that. Time went on, and they and the administration, but first Scott Walker and Tony Evers, found that the timeline was a little hasty, that to build these new facilities and move the inmates from the current ones to the new ones was going to take more time. And so Evers asked for sort of an open-ended schedule of, well, we'll close it as soon as possible. Republicans were very opposed to that, and many Democrats were very opposed to that, saying you need a hard deadline. We'll give you a six-month extension. So just less than a year ago, they passed a new law that said it would close by the summer of 2021. This last week, the legislature's budget committee essentially abandoned that idea, abandoned that timeline. They funded part of the projects to replace Lincoln Hills, but not all of them. And they've acknowledged now that because of what these funding decisions they've made, the state won't meet that deadline. We don't know when Lincoln Hills will close. Frankly, we don't really know if it will ever close given the parameters they've set, though, you know, lawmakers could address this in the future by funding these new facilities they say they want to build.
So what is the status of these new regional facilities that are meant to ultimately replace Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake?
So it's all over the map. There's four county facilities that the budget committee approved, but they shorted Milwaukee County on funding for its project, so there's not there'd be no place to house female offenders from Milwaukee County. And they, although they shorted Milwaukee County, in all they wanted to give $20 million more than what they had available. So they need to get permission from another state entity, the State Building Commission, to fully fund those four facilities, and that would be $100 million in all. But there's also supposed to be two state-run facilities that would be more secure for, in many cases, higher-risk offenders, and that is expected to cost about $74 million. They didn't fund any of that, so there's no plan to build those facilities. There also needs to be an expanded mental health facility in Madison at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center. That's ready to go, but lawmakers have not funded it yet, so that remains on hold as well. So you've really got about a third of what they need to do has gotten some sort of initial approval, but not the final approval to put shovels in the ground.
So while lawmakers are having this broader debate about juvenile corrections and how it should be structured, do you have a sense at all whether conditions have improved for inmates and staff at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake?
They say that they have, both the Department of Corrections and the ACLU, which brought the lawsuit against the state over conditions there, say that things have improved. It can be a bumpy road, as the Secretary of Corrections recently put it. They did last fall have some outbursts that were pretty problematic, and they had to involve law enforcement. Charges were issued in at least one case out of that. So it's not like everything is as it should be necessarily there, but they seem to be improved from when they were experiencing the most problems there.
Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Marley is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He covers state politics from the Capitol in Madison. Just ahead, we explore African-American genealogy and tracing your family's roots back before emancipation in 1863 with a genealogy specialist from the Wisconsin Historical Society. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.